The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued. Cassette 4, Side 2.
Yes, there was simply no province, be it Chelyabinsk or Kvibyshev, which did not give birth to its own camps. A new method of creating camps was adopted after the exile of the Germans from the Volga. Whole dispossessed villages were enclosed, just as they were, in a camp compound, and these were the agricultural camp sectors, the Kamensky agricultural camps between Kamyshin and Engels. We ask the reader's pardon for the many gaps and flaws in this chapter. We have cast only a frail bridge across the whole epoch of the archipelago, simply because we did not have any more material available. We could not broadcast pleas for more on the radio. Here, once again, the crimson star of Naftali Frankel describes an intricate loop in the heavens of the archipelago. The year 1937, which struck down its very own, did not spare his head either. Chief of Bamlag, an NKVD general, he was once again, out of gratitude, imprisoned in the Lubyanka, with which he was already familiar. But Frankel, nonetheless, did not weary of thirsting for the one true service, nor did the wise teacher weary of seeking out this service. The shameful and unsuccessful war with Finland began, and Stalin saw that he was unprepared, that there were no supply lines to his army thrust out into the Karelian snows. And he remembered the inventive Frankel and called him in. It was necessary right then, in the fierce winter, without any preparation whatsoever, without any existing plans even, or warehouses, or automobile roads, to build three railroads in Karelia, one rocade paralleling the border, and two more leading up to it, and to build them in the course of 3 months, because it was simply a disgrace for such a great power to mess about with that little pug-dog Finland for such a long time. This was straight out of a fairy tale. The evil king ordered the evil sorcerer to do something totally impossible and unimaginable. And so the leader of socialism asked, "Can you?" And the joyous merchant and black market currency speculator answered, "Yes." But this time he set his conditions. One, that he be taken out of Gulag entirely, and that a new Czech empire be founded, a new autonomous archipelago called Gulzids, pronounced Gulzides, the chief administration of camps for railroad construction, and that as head of this archipelago there be named Frankel. Two, that all the national resources he selected would be put at his disposal. This was not going to be another Bellamore. Three, that during the period of extreme emergency operation, Gulzides would also be removed from the socialist system with its exasperating accounting procedures. Frankel would not be required to render accounts about anything. He did not set up tents and did not establish any camps. He had no rations, no system of differentiated dining facilities, and no system of differentiated food pots. And it was he who had proposed the system of different levels of rations in the first place. Only a genius can repeal the laws of a genius. He piled up in the snow heaps of the best food, together with sheepskin coats and felt boots, and every Czech could put on whatever he pleased and eat as much as he wanted. Only the Makorka and the Vodka were controlled by his assistants, and they were the only things which had to be earned. The great strategist was willing, and Gulzides was created. Was the archipelago split in two? No. The archipelago only grew stronger, multiplied, and would proceed to take over the whole country even more swiftly. Frankel, however, did not succeed in completing his Karelian railroads. Stalin hurried to end the war in a draw. But Gulzides hardened and grew. It received more and more new orders to carry out, but now with normal accounting procedures. There was the Rocade Railroad paralleling the Iranian border, then the Rocade Railroad paralleling the Volga from Sizran near Kvibyshev on down to Stalingrad, and then the Railroad of Death from Sarekhard to Igarka, and then BAM proper, the Baikal-Amur main line from Taishet to Bratsk and farther. Further, Frenkel's idea enriched the development of Gulag itself. It came to be considered necessary to organize Gulag itself in terms of branch administrations. Just as the Sovnarkom, the Council of People's Commissars, consisted of Narkomats, People's Commissariats, so Gulag created its own ministries for its own empire. Glavleslag, the chief administration of logging camps. Glavpromstroy, the chief administration of camps for industrial construction. GULGMP, the chief administration of camps for the mining and metallurgical industry. Then came the war, and all these Gulag ministries were evacuated to various cities. Gulag itself landed in Ufa, Gulzhides in Vyatka. The communications between provincial cities were by no means so reliable as the radio communications out of Moscow, and for the whole first half of the war, it was as if Gulag had disintegrated. It no longer ran the whole archipelago, and each surrounding area of the archipelago was subordinate to the administration evacuated to it. Thus it was that it fell on Frenkel to run the entire Russian northeast from Kirov, because other than the archipelago, there was almost nothing else there. But those who envisioned in this the fall of the Roman Empire were mistaken, for it would gather itself together again after the war in even greater majesty. Frenkel remembered an old friendship. He summoned and named to an important position in Gulzhides a man named Bukhaltsev, who had been the editor of his yellow sheet, the Kopeck, in pre-revolutionary Mariupol, and whose colleagues had either been shot or scattered across the face of the earth. Frenkel's talents were outstanding not only in commerce and organization. Taking in rows of figures at a glance, he could add them up in his head. He loved to brag that he could recognize 40,000 prisoners by face, and that he knew the family name, given name, and patronymic of each, their code article and their term. And it was required procedure in his camps to announce all this information at the approach of high-ranking chiefs. He always managed without a chief engineer, looking at a plan for a railroad station that had been brought him. He was quick to note a mistake in it, and then he would crumple up the plan, throw it in his subordinate's face, and say, "It's time you understand that you are not a designer, just a jackass." He had a nasal twang, and his voice was ordinarily calm. He was short. He used to wear the high caracul hat, the papacha, of a railroad general, dark blue on top, with a red lining. And he always, through the varied years, wore a field jacket of military cut, a garment which simultaneously constituted a claim to being a leader of the state and a declaration of not belonging to the intelligentsia. Like Trotsky, he always lived aboard trains, travelling around his scattered construction battlefields. And those summoned from the discomfort in which natives of the archipelago lived to confer with him in his railroad car were astonished at his bentwood chairs, his upholstered furniture, and were all the more timid in confronting the reproaches and orders of their chief. He himself never entered a single barracks, never smelled all that stench. He asked and demanded only work. He particularly loved to telephone construction projects at night, helping to perpetuate the legend about himself that he never slept. And in fact, during Stalin's era, many other big shots were accustomed to do the same. He never married. He was never again arrested. He became Karganovich's deputy for railroad construction, and died in Moscow in the 50s with the rank of lieutenant general, in old age, in honor, and in peace. I have the feeling that he really hated this country. Chapter 5. What the Archipelago Stands On. There used to be a city in the Far East with the loyal name of Tsetsarevich, Crown Prince. The revolution saw it renamed Svobodny, meaning free. The Amur Cossacks, who once inhabited the city, were scattered, and the city was empty. They had to resettle it with someone. And they did, with prisoners and the Czechists guarding them. The whole city of Svobodny became a camp, Bamlag. And so it is that symbols are spontaneously born of life. The camps are not merely the dark side of our post-revolutionary life. Their scale made them not an aspect, not just a side, but very nearly the very liver of events. It was rare for our half-century so to manifest itself so consistently, with such finality. Just as every point is formed by the intersection of at least two lines, every event is formed by the intersection of at least two necessities. And so, although on one hand our economic requirements led us to the system of camps, this by itself might have led us to labor armies, but it intersected with the theoretical justification for the camps, fortunately already formulated. And so they met and grew together, like a thorn into a nest or a protuberance into a hollow. And that is how the archipelago was born. The economic need manifested itself, as always, openly and greedily. For the state, which had decided to strengthen itself in a very short period of time, and here three-quarters of the matter was in the period allotted, just as with Bellamore, and which did not require anything from outside, the need was manpower. A. Cheap in the extreme, and better still, for free. B. Undemanding, capable of being shifted about from place to place any day of the week, free of family ties, not requiring either established housing or schools or hospitals, or even, for a certain length of time, kitchens and baths. It was possible to obtain such manpower only by swallowing up one's own sons. The theoretical justification could not have been formulated with such conviction in the haste of those years, had it not had its beginnings in the past century. Engels discovered that the human being had arisen not through the perception of a moral idea, and not through the process of thought, but out of happenstance and meaningless work. An ape picked up a stone, and with this everything began. Marx, concerning himself with a less remote time, Critique of the Gotha Program, declared with equal conviction that the one and only means of correcting offenders, true, he referred here to criminals, he never even conceived that his pupils might consider politicals offenders, was not solitary contemplation, not moral soul-searching, not repentance, and not languishing, for all that was superstructure, but productive labor. He himself had never in his life taken a pick in hand. To the end of his days he never pushed a wheelbarrow, mined coal, felled timber. And we don't even know how his firewood was split. But he wrote that down on paper, and the paper did not resist. And for his followers, everything now fell into place. To compel a prisoner to labor every day, sometimes 14 hours at a time, as at the Colima mine faces, was humane and would lead to his correction. On the contrary, to limit his confinement to a prison cell, courtyard, and vegetable garden, to give him the chance to read books, write, think, and argue during these years meant to treat him like cattle. This is from that same Critique of the Gotha Program. True, in the heated times immediately following the October Revolution, they paid little heed to these subtleties, and it seemed even more humane simply to shoot them. And those whom they did not shoot, but imprisoned in the earliest camps, were imprisoned there not for purposes of correction, but to render them harmless, purely for quarantine. The point is that even then some minds were occupied with penal theory, for example Pyotr Stuchka, and in the Guiding Principles of the Criminal Law of the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic of 1919, the very concept of punishment was subjected to a new definition. Punishment, it was there very refreshingly affirmed, is neither revenge, the workers' and peasants' state was not taking vengeance on an offender, nor expiation of guilt. There is no such thing as individual guilt, merely class causation, but a defensive measure to protect the social structure, a measure of social defense. Once it is accepted as a measure of social defense, then it follows that war is war, and you either have to shoot, the supreme measure of social defense, or else imprison. But in this the idea of correction had somehow gotten muddied, though in that very same 1919 the Eighth Congress of the Party had called for correction. And foremost it had become incomprehensible. What should one be corrected for if there had been no guilt? It was hardly possible to be corrected for class causation. By then the Civil War had come to an end. In 1922, the first Soviet codes were established. In 1923, the Congress of the Penitentiary Labour Workers took place. The new basic principles of criminal legislation were composed in 1924, the foundations of the new criminal code of 1926, which hung around our necks for 35 years. And through all this, the newly found concepts that there is no guilt and no punishment, but that there is social danger and social defence, remained intact. Of course, this was more convenient. Such a theory made it possible to arrest anyone as a hostage, as a doubtful person, Lenin's telegram to Yevgenia Bosch, even to exile entire peoples because they were dangerous, and the examples are well known. But given all this, one had to be a first-class juggler in order still to construct and maintain in purified form the theory of correction. However, there were jugglers, and the theory was there, and the camps were indeed called corrective. And we can bring many quotations to bear even now. Vyshinsky, all Soviet penal policy is based on a dialectical, combination of the principle of repression and compulsion with the principle of persuasion and re-education. All bourgeois penitentiary institutions try to harass the criminal by subjecting him to physical and moral suffering. They wish to reform him. In distinction from bourgeois punishment, the sufferings of the prisoners in our country are not an end, but a means. Just as there, too, it would seem, not an end, but a means. A.S. The end in our country is genuine reform, genuine correction, so conscientious labourers should emerge from the camps. Now, have you got it? Even though we use compulsion, we are nonetheless correcting, and also, as it turns out, via suffering, except it is not known exactly from what. But right then and there, on a nearby page, we find, with the assistance of revolutionary violence, the corrective labour camps localise and render harmless the criminal elements of the old society. We are still talking about the old society, and even in 1952 we still keep talking about the old society. Pile everything on the wolf's neck. Blame it all on the old society. So, not a single word about correction. We are localising and rendering harmless. And then in that same 1934, the two-in-one task is suppression plus re-education of anyone who can be re-educated. Of anyone who can be re-educated. It becomes clear that correction is not for everyone. And now, a ready-made phrase from somewhere already flits about among the small-time authors, the correction of the corrigibles. The correction of the corrigibles. And what about the incorrigibles? Into a common grave? To the moon, Kolyma. Below Shmiditka, Norilsk. Even the corrective labour code of 1924 was criticised by Vyshinsky's jurists from the height of 1934 for a false concept of universal correction. Because this code says nothing about destruction. No one promised that they would correct the 58s. And therefore I have called this part the destructive labour camps. That's how we felt them on our pelts. And if some of the jurists' quotations fit together crookedly, so be it. Just go raise up Stuchka from the grave, or drag out Vyshinsky, and let them make head or tail of it. I am not to blame. It is only now, on sitting down to write my own book, that I decided to leaf through my predecessor's works. Yes, good people had to help even here, because you'd not now be able to find their works anywhere. And as we dragged our soiled camp pea jackets about, we never even guessed at the existence of such books. that all our life there in camp was determined not by the will of the citizen chief, but by some kind of legendary labor code for prisoners. That was not just an obscure latrine rumor for us alone. Even the chief of the camp, a major, wouldn't have believed it for anything. Published in an edition for official use only, never held in anyone's hands, and no one knew whether they were still kept in the gulag safes or whether they had all been burned as wrecking activity. Neither were quotations from them hung up in the cultural and educational corners, nor were their miserable figures proclaimed from the wooden rostrums. How many hours long was the work day? How many rest days in a month? Is there payment for labor? Was there any provision for mutilation? Yes, and you would get a big hoarse laugh from your fellow zecs, too, if you even asked such questions. Our diplomats were the ones who had seen and read these humane words. They had, it would seem, held up and brandished this booklet at international conferences. Indeed, I myself have only now obtained the quotations, and even now my tears flow. In the Guiding Principles of 1919, given the fact that punishment is not vengeance, then it may include no elements of torture. In 1920, the use of the condescending familiar form of address is forbidden in speaking to the prisoners. And forgive my language, but what about blank in the mouth? Is that permissible? The Corrective Labor Code of 1924, Article 49. The prison regime must be deprived of all elements of torture, handcuffs, punishment cells, strict solitary confinement, deprivation of food, visits through a grating only, are under no circumstances permitted. Well, that's enough. And there are no later instructions. That's enough even for the diplomats. And not even that is needed by Gulag. And in the Criminal Code of 1926, there was an Article 9. I learned about it by chance, and learned it by heart. Measures of social defense may not have as their purpose the infliction of physical suffering or the humiliation of human dignity, and do not aim at exacting revenge and retribution. Now that is clarity for you, because I enjoyed catching our bosses out on legal grounds. I often rattled off this section to them. And all these protectors of ours only popped their eyes in astonishment and indignation. There were old veterans who had served for 20 years, who were nearing their pensions, who had never yet heard of any Article 9, and for that matter had never held the code in their hands. Oh, what an intelligent, far-sighted, humane administration from top to bottom, as Supreme Court Judge Leibovitz of New York State wrote in Life magazine after having visited Gulag. In serving out his term of punishment, the prisoner retains a feeling of dignity. That is what he comprehended and saw. Oh, fortunate New York State to have such a perspicacious jackass for a judge. And oh, you well-fed, devil-may-care, near-sighted, irresponsible foreigners with your notebooks and your ballpoint pens, beginning with those correspondents who back in Chem asked the Zecs questions in the presence of the camp chiefs. How much you have harmed us in your vain passion to shine with understanding in areas where you did not grasp a lousy thing. Human dignity of persons condemned without trial, who are made to sit down beside Stolypin cars at stations with their rear ends in the mud, who, at the whistle of the citizen jailer's lash, scrape up with their hands the urine-soaked earth and carry it away, so as not to be sentenced to the punishment block. Of those educated women who, as a great honour, have been found worthy of laundering the linen of the citizen chief of the camp, and of feeding his privately owned pigs, and who, at his first drunken gesture, have to make themselves available, so as not to perish on general work the next day. Fire, fire! The branches crackle, and the night wind of late autumn blows the flame of the bonfire back and forth. The compound is dark. I am alone at the bonfire, and I can bring it still more carpenter's shavings. The compound here is a privileged one, so privileged that it is almost as if I were out in freedom. This is an island of paradise. This is the Martino Sharashka, a scientific institute staffed with prisoners, in its most privileged period. No one is overseeing me, calling me to a cell, chasing me away from the bonfire. I am wrapped in a padded jacket, and even then it is chilly in the penetrating wind. But she, who has already been standing in the wind for hours, her arms straight down, her head drooping, weeping, then growing numb and still. And then again she begs piteously, "Citizen Chief, forgive me. Please forgive me. I won't do it again." The wind carries her moan to me just as if she were moaning next to my ear. The Citizen Chief at the gatehouse fires up his stove and does not answer. This was the gatehouse of the camp next door to us, from which workers came into our compound to lay water pipes and to repair the old ramshackle seminary building. Across from me, beyond the artfully intertwined, many-stranded barbed wire barricade, and 2 steps away from the gatehouse, beneath a bright lantern, stood the punished girl, head hanging, the wind tugging at her grey work skirt, her feet growing numb from the cold, a thin scarf over her head. It had been warm during the day when they had been digging a ditch on our territory, and another girl, slipping down into a ravine, had crawled her way to the Vladikino highway and escaped. The guard had bungled, and Moscow City buses ran right along the highway. When they caught on, it was too late to catch her. They raised the alarm. A mean, dark major arrived and shouted that if they failed to catch the fugitive girl, the entire camp would be deprived of visits and parcels for a whole month because of her escape. And the women brigadiers went into a rage, and they were all shouting, one of them in particular, who kept viciously rolling her eyes, "Oh, I hope they catch her, the bitch! I hope they take scissors and clip, clip, take off all her hair in front of the lineup." This wasn't something she had thought of herself. This was the way they punished women in Gulag. But the girl who was now standing outside the gatehouse in the cold had sighed and said instead, "At least she can have a good time out in freedom for all of us." The jailer overheard what she said, and now she was being punished. Everyone else had been taken off to the camp, but she had been set outside there to stand at attention in front of the gatehouse. This had been at 6 p.m., and it was now 11 p.m. She tried to shift from one foot to another, but the guard stuck out his head and shouted, "Stand at attention, whore, or else it will be worse for you." And now she was not moving, only weeping. "Forgive me, Citizen Chief. Let me into the camp. I won't do it any more." But even in the camp, no one was about to say to her, "All right, idiot, come on in." The reason they were keeping her out there so long was that the next day was Sunday and she would not be needed for work. Such a straw-blonde, naive, uneducated slip of a girl. She had been imprisoned for some spool of thread. What a dangerous thought you expressed there, little sister. They want to teach you a lesson for the rest of your life. Fire, fire. We fought the war, and we looked into the bonfires to see what kind of a victory it would be. The wind wafted a glowing husk from the bonfire. To that flame, and to you, girl, I promise, the whole wide world will read about you. This was happening at the end of 1947, a few days before the 30th anniversary of the October Revolution, in our capital city of Moscow, which had just celebrated 800 years of its cruelties, little more than a mile away from the All-Union Agricultural Fairgrounds, and a half mile away from the Ostankino Museum of Serf Arts and Handicrafts. Serfs. This comparison occurred to many when they had had the time to think about it, and not accidentally either. Not just individual features, but the whole central meaning of their existence was identical for serfdom and the archipelago. They were forms of social organization for the forced and pitiless exploitation of the unpaid labor of millions of slaves. 6 days a week, and often 7, the natives of the archipelago went out to fatiguing barschina, forced labor, which did not bring them even the least little return. They were allowed neither a fifth day nor even a seventh in which to work for themselves, because their sustenance was a messiacina, a monthly serf ration, a camp ration. They were divided, just as precisely, into the categories of those paying their dues in the form of forced labour, Group A, and the household serfs, Group B, who directly served the estate owner, chief of the camp, and the estate, the compound. Only those totally unable to get down from their peasant stoves, board bunks, were recognized as infirm, Group C, and similarly there were punishments for offenders, Group D, except for the difference that the estate owner, acting in his own interests, punished with a lash in the stable and the loss of fewer work days, and he had no punishment block, whereas, in accordance with state instructions, the chief of the camp placed the culprit in the shizo, the penalty isolator, or the BUR, the strict regimen barracks. Like the estate owner, the chief of camp could take any slave to be his lackey, cook, barber, or jester. And he could also assemble a serf theatre, if he wished. He could take any slave woman as a housekeeper, a concubine, or a servant. Like an estate owner, he could play tricks and show his temper as much as he liked. The chief of the Kimki camp, Major Volkov, noticed that a girl prisoner was drying her long flaxen locks in the sun after washing them, and for some reason this made him angry, and he shouted, "Cut off her hair!" And they immediately cut all her hair off. That was in 1945. And whenever the camp chief or the estate owner changed, all the slaves obediently awaited the new master, made guesses about his habits, and surrendered in advance to his power. Being incapable of foreseeing what the will of the master would be, the serf took little thought for the morrow, nor did the prisoner. The serf could not marry without the master's permission. And it was even more the case that a prisoner could acquire a camp wife only with the indulgence of the camp chief. Just as a serf had not chosen his slave's fate, since he was not to blame for his birth, neither did the prisoner choose his. He also got into the archipelago by pure fate. This similarity has long since been discerned by the Russian language. Have you fed the people? Have you sent the people out to work? How many people do you have there? Send me one person. People. People. Whom do they mean? That's the way they talked about serfs, and that is how they speak about prisoners. And that is also the way they talk about the collective farmers and unskilled labourers, but we are not going to carry this any further. One cannot speak like that about officers or leaders, however. How many people do you have? No one would understand you. But there are some who will object that nonetheless there are really not so many similarities between serfs and prisoners. There are more differences. And we agree with that, there are more differences. But what is surprising is that all the differences are to the credit of serfdom. All the differences are to the discredit of the Gulag Archipelago. The serfs did not work longer than from sunrise to sunset. The Zeks started work in darkness and ended in darkness, and they didn't always end either. For the serfs, Sundays were sacred, and the 12 sacred Orthodox holidays as well, and local saints' days, and a certain number of the 12 days of Christmas. They went about in mummers' costumes. The prisoner was fearful on the eve of every Sunday. He didn't know whether they would get it off, and he never got holidays at all. Just as the Volga didn't get any days off, remember? Those 1sts of May and those 7ths of November involved more miseries with searches and special regimen than the holidays were worth, and a certain number were put into punishment blocks every year precisely on those very days. For the serfs, Christmas and Easter were genuine holidays, and as for a body search, either after work or on the morning or at night, stand next to your cots! The serfs knew not of these. The serfs lived in permanent huts, regarding them as their own, and when at night they lay down on top of their stoves or on their sleeping platform between ceiling and stove, their polati, or else on a bench. They knew. This is my own place. I have slept here forever and ever, and I always will. The prisoner did not know what barracks he would be in on the morrow, and even when he returned from work he could not be certain that he would sleep in that place that night. He did not have his own sleeping shelf, or his own multiple bunk. He went wherever they drove him. The serf on Barshchina, or forced labour, had his own horse, his own wooden plough, axe, scythe, spindle, chests, dishes, and clothes. Even the household serfs, as Herzen writes, always had some clothes of their own, which they could leave to their nearest and dearest, and which were almost never taken away by the estate owner. In spring, the Zek was forced to turn in his winter clothing, and in the autumn to turn in his summer clothing. At inventories, they emptied his bag and took away for the government every extra piece of clothing. He was not permitted to have even a small penknife or a bowl, and as far as livestock was concerned, only lice. One way or another, a serf would cast his line and catch a fish. The Zek caught fish only with a spoon, and only in his gruel. The serf had a little cow named Brownie, or at least a goat and chickens. The Zek's lips never touched milk, and he'd never seen hen's eggs for whole decades, and probably he'd not recognize them if he did. Old Russia, which experienced Asiatic slavery for 7 whole centuries, did not, for the most part, know famine. In Russia, no one has ever died of starvation, said the proverb. And a proverb is not made up out of lies and nonsense. The serfs were slaves, but they had full bellies. There is testimony on this for all the Russian centuries. In the 17th, Yuri Krizanich wrote that the peasants and artisans of Muscovy lived more bountifully than those of the West, that the poorest inhabitants in Russia ate good bread, fish, meat. Even in the time of troubles, the long-preserved granaries had not been exhausted. There were stacks standing in the fields. Threshing floors were filled full with specially stacked sheaves and stooks and haystacks for from 4 to 10 years, Avrami Palitsin. In the 18th century, Funvidzin, comparing the standard of living of the Russian peasants with that of the peasants of Languedoc, Provence, wrote, "I find, objectively judging things, that the state of our peasants is incomparably happier." In the 19th century, Pushkin wrote of the serf village, "The evidence of abundance and work is everywhere." The archipelago lived for decades in the grip of cruel famine. The Zeks would scuffle over a herring tail from the garbage pail. For Christmas and Easter, even the thinnest serf peasant broke his fast with fat bacon. But even the best work in camp could get fat bacon only in parcels from home. The serfs lived in families. The sale or exchange of a serf away from his family was a universally recognized and proclaimed barbarism. Popular Russian literature waxed indignant over this. Hundreds of serfs, perhaps thousands, but this is unlikely, were torn from their families, but not millions. The Zek was separated from his family on the first day of his arrest, and, in 50% of all cases, forever. If a son was arrested with his father, as we heard from Witkowski, or a wife together with her husband, the greatest care was taken to see that they did not meet at the same camp. And if by some chance they did meet, they were separated as quickly as possible. Similarly, every time a man and a woman Zek came together in camp for fleeting or real love, they hastened to penalize them with the punishment cell, to separate them and send them away from one another. And even the most sentimental of our writing ladies, Mariata Shaginyan or Tatiana Tess, never let fall a single silent tear into their kerchiefs about that. Well, of course, they didn't know, or else thought it was necessary. And even the herding of serfs from one place to another didn't occur in a frenzy of haste. They were permitted to pack their goods and chattels, to gather up their movables, and to move calmly a score or so of miles away. But a prisoner transport would hit the Zec like a sudden squall, 20 minutes or 10, just time enough to turn in camp property, and his entire life would be turned upside down, and he would go off somewhere to the ends of the earth, maybe forever. In the life of one serf there was hardly ever more than one move, and most often they stayed put. But a native of the archipelago, unfamiliar with prisoner transports, couldn't have been found. And many Zecs were moved 5, 7, 11 times. Some serfs managed to escape to the freer obrok system, a fixed money payment to the serf owner, and the obrok serfs might travel far out of sight of the cursed master, go into trade, enrich themselves, and live like free people. But even the Zecs, privileged enough to go about without convoy, lived inside that same camp compound, and had to drag themselves early in the morning to the very same type of work to which the column of the other Zecs was driven. The household serfs were, for the most part, degenerate parasites. Servants are a boorish spawn, as the saying goes. They lived off the labor of the Barshchina serfs, but at least they themselves did not rule over the Barshchina serfs. It was doubly nauseating for the Zec that, in addition to everything else, the degenerate trustees directed them and ordered them around. And in general, the entire situation of the serfs was alleviated by the fact that the estate owner had necessarily to be merciful to them. They were worth money. Their work brought him wealth. The camp chief was merciless to the prisoners. He had not bought them, and he would not be willing them to his children. And if they died, others would be sent him. No, we got ourselves involved to no purpose in comparing our Zecs with the serfs of the estate owners. The situation of the latter, one has to admit, was very much less harried and more humane. A closer comparison of the situation of the natives of the archipelago would be with the factory serfs of the Urals, the Altai and Nerchinsk, or the inhabitants of the Arakchayev semi-military settlements. Some people object, however, even to this. They, too, had it good in the Arakchayev settlements. There were also nature, family, and holidays. Only the slavery of the ancient East is a fair comparison. And there is only one, just one, plus which comes to mind on the side of the Zecs as opposed to the serfs. The prisoner might land in the archipelago even as a juvenile of 12 to 15, but not from the very date of his birth. He did at least snatch a number of years in freedom before imprisonment. As for the advantage of a definite sentence in comparison with the lifetime of peasant serfdom, there are many qualifications. Namely, if the term was not a quarter, 25 years, if the article was not 58, if he wasn't until special orders, if they didn't paste a second term on the prisoner in camp, if at the end of his term the prisoner was not automatically sent off into exile, if the prisoner after being released was not sent straight back to the archipelago as a repeater. There is such a fence of qualifications, in fact, that, after all, it is only fair to recall that sometimes the nobleman master, too, might manumit his serf out of whimsy. That is why, when the Emperor Mikhail informed us at the Lubyanka about the anecdotal deciphering of the initials of the Soviet Bolshevik Party, VKPB, current among Moscow workers at that time as Vtoroye Krepostnoye Pravo, Bolsheviks, Second Serfdom, Bolsheviks.
This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.